And welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. When Australians are told that we had a concentration camp, officially a concentration camp, for, believe it or not, Jews in Australia during the Second World War, they are, to say the least, nonplussed. It's perfectly true. It's a story I've been trying to tell and retell in this program for many years. And tonight we're going to hear from its youngest prisoner. He was, I think, about 15 at the time. He's now 90 years old. His name is Walter Kaufmann. And we're then going to have a look at the possibilities of a democratic Hong Kong. It seems only yesterday I took the program to Honkers for the changeover, the handover ceremonies, and I have a vivid memory of standing in the rain, being absolutely saturated, as, in fact, was Prince Charles and all the other dignitaries, as this rather sad ceremony took place. It was followed by a fireworks display that was all but distinguished by the heavy rain, as the royal yacht Britannia sailed off into the past. Now there are fireworks aplenty in Hong Kong again, but they are of a political nature. But we begin tonight with reaction to Obama's strategy speech on defeating, or as he puts it, degrading Islamic State, a.k.a. ISIS and ISIL, in Iraq and Syria. Obama, like most American presidents, tends to aim his message at U.S. voters and to the pundits and politicians inside the Beltway. But we want to try and gauge the reaction to the speech from or in the Middle East. And on the blower from Beirut is Lena Hatib. Lena is director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Lena, would you please be kind enough to mark the president's homework? What did you think of the speech?
The speech marked a significant turn in U.S. foreign policy towards the Syrian conflict, because this is the first time that we've seen declaration of intention on part of the United States to engage in this conflict militarily. This is important because so far U.S. foreign policy had been very quiet regarding this conflict, and I think it contributed to the rise of Islamist jihadist groups like the Islamic State. And the speech was also very positive in that it made sure that it told Arab countries that they are also responsible for taking part in securing the region against Islamism with international cooperation, which I hope will lead to a change in the status quo in the region, to decrease rivalries among Arab countries and increase international cooperation on counterterrorism more widely.
Now, of course, the response will vary from country to country. There can't be a bland, generalized Middle Eastern response. But where you are in Beirut at the moment, what's the local reaction?
The local reaction is one of basically lack of surprise. I think people had for some time been expecting the United States to eventually be pushed towards intervention in Syria one way or another. It was a sense of exasperation, really, because especially last summer, people had expected the United States to take military action, and there was wide disappointment when that did not happen. So I think now it's a case of, see, we told you so. If you had intervened last year, we would not have been in this situation today. So today we are relieved that you are intervening, but at the same time, you know, people are not expecting, glorious results as a result of this intervention, simply because the situation on the ground in Syria is definitely more complex than ever before. So people are positive, but yet they're also very cautious.
As you and I are speaking, Kerry will be in Saudi or rapidly approaching it, and Saudi Arabia has agreed to an American request to provide a base to train moderate Syrian opposition fighters. Is it easy to identify the moderates, Lena?
Actually, yes, it is. The moderate fighters are mainly represented militarily through the Free Syrian Army Brigades and politically through not just the Syrian coalition abroad, but also through a number of actors who are actually well known to the West, who have been there from the very beginning. But the problem is they did not have a viable mechanism in order to operate politically. We have to distinguish, actually, you know, now that we're talking about this, that when President Obama spoke about the moderate Syrian opposition, he wasn't talking about the political angle of it, but was really talking about the military angle, meaning the Free Syrian Army. And the Free Syrian Army has been engaged with the United States for some time now through small-scale programs providing training and intelligence and some capacity building. So the U.S. already has identified who these partners are. Otherwise, I don't think it would have, you know, made this kind of public commitment.
Lena, I would wholeheartedly agree with you that something you wrote recently, that if ISIS is to be defeated, it needs the Saudis and the Iranians to help the Americans. Any mention of the Iranians in Obama's speech?
It's very interesting that Iran was missing from the speech. However, President Obama also spoke about a broad coalition. So that leaves the door open for Iran to be involved in the coalition further down the line. And actually, we know that back-channel talks have been taking place between Saudi Arabia and Iran for some time now, driven by the shared concern over the Islamic State, which is an enemy to both Saudi Arabia and Iran. The problem is, so far we don't know what the nature of compromise or cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Iran might be. However, I think the United States is definitely working on that track, and I think we can expect to see Iranian involvement, whether direct or indirect, sometime in the future.
Lena, as I said, you're in Lebanon, where the Iranian-backed Hezbollah was a dominant political force. Has Hezbollah made a public statement?
Not yet. Hezbollah has not yet reacted to the Obama speech, and that's also because Iran is behind the scenes also trying to decide where it stands. I personally think that Iran leans more towards indirect cooperation with the U.S. than the other way around, and I think that Iran further down the line would not be averse to sacrificing Assad if an alternative exists that would maintain its own interests in Syria and the region more widely. And I think Hezbollah will not make any public statement unless Iran makes a decision one way or another. And considering that I think Iran is leaning more towards cooperation than anything else, I expect Hezbollah to remain very quiet for the time being.
Lena, we've already mentioned that the president doesn't mention Iran in the speech, and yes, it'll be critical. Not only does he not mention them, but they won't be at that big meeting in Saudi Arabia tomorrow. They weren't invited, were they?
Actually, the Iranians have not been officially invited, but they are there. They are not participating in the meeting, but they are present in Saudi Arabia. So as I said, the way Iran is involved in the discussion is behind the scenes. And this is even more important, I think, than the you know, what the public is seeing with the official meeting itself.
Of course, if it's to work, the Saudi Arabians and the Iranians have to reach a degree of compromise, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a big issue because both countries see themselves as key regional actors in the Middle East with their own set of clients and interests that go well beyond their borders. And the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran has contributed to a number of conflicts and confrontations that we are seeing in the region, whether in Lebanon or Syria or Iraq or Yemen or even in Bahrain. So I think reaching even a basic compromise between Iran and Saudi Arabia would go a long way towards stabilizing the situation in the Middle East. But this is not going to be easy, especially that within Saudi Arabia and within Iran, there isn't a uniform opinion because different factors and political actors within those countries have quite different views about, you know, what should be done.
The topic is Degrading ISIS, the Obama Strategy. The program is LNL on RN. And my guest is Lena Hatib, who's the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, from where she is talking to us. Lena, in the past year or so, there's been endless discussions, quite a lot of them on this program, about the importance of social media, you know, right from the first stirrings in Cairo. Social media has been a remarkable tool, but it's also proving to be a pretty remarkable tool for the Islamic State. Are you impressed by, as impressed by others, by what is regarded as a very skillful media strategy?
I'm not sure impressed is the right word. I am definitely monitoring what the Islamic State is doing. And definitely the Islamic State is heavily reliant on the social media, and that's for a number of reasons. One is because it's interested in recruiting more and more people abroad. And second is because it does not have the means to create its own media mouthpieces. So it has a radio station, but that radio station can only broadcast in areas, you know, under its control. You know, it's unthinkable to imagine international satellites allowing, you know, Islamic State broadcasts on television, for example. So. In a way, the Islamic State has no choice but to resort to the social media as a quick method of international outreach. And it is definitely using a very centralized and systematic campaign through the social media for recruitment, to raise money, and to, in a way, advertise itself as the strongest and richest terrorist group in the world.
Would you regard it as desirable to pull the plug on their use of social media?
I think yes, because the Islamic State is so dependent on the social media that it does not have much of an alternative in this regard. And if you basically prevent it from using the social media for recruitment and propaganda, you would, you know, be limiting the scope of its operations internationally, which I think is important.
Over the past week or so, in Lebanon, Islamic State has kidnapped and executed Lebanese soldiers. Why has Lebanon become a prime target?
I wouldn't say Lebanon is a prime target. However, it has become a target ever since Lebanese Hezbollah started confronting ISIS in Syria alongside the Lebanese border. A bit of background here. Until the advance of the Islamic State in Iraq, which happened in June of this year, the Islamic State actually did not engage in battles with the Syrian regime or with Hezbollah. And that's because the Syrian regime had turned a blind eye to the Islamic State because the regime regarded it as being useful, because the Islamic State was fighting the Free Syrian Army as well as other Syrian rebels that the regime was fighting. So in a way, it was doing the fight of the regime for the regime, you know, in an indirect way. But when the Islamic State advanced into Iraq and edged closer to Iran, which is a key ally of Assad, suddenly the Islamic State, you know, became an enemy for the regime. And this is when Hezbollah all of a sudden became a target for the Islamic State, because Hezbollah is fighting in Syria on the side of the regime. And that partly explains why the Islamic State had this incursion into Lebanon last month.
So let's go back to your starting point. You feel that there's a general response that Obama's speech is too little and too late.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's too little, too late. I think now there's no going back. The United States has made this public commitment. It will engage in a military campaign. It will rally international, you know, other countries to cooperate with it. However, we're in it for the long run. It's not going to be easy to eradicate the Islamic State in a matter of months or even, you know, few years. This is going to be a very long-term campaign. campaign. It's going to be perhaps more complicated than other military interventions that the U.S. has been involved in recently, such as Yemen and Somalia. And so I think it's far from ideal, you know, that this U.S. response is happening now and in this way. Had the U.S. intervened diplomatically very early on in the Syrian uprising, we would not be where we are right now. However, speaking pragmatically, the speech and the strategy that's presented is certainly better than the alternative, which is doing nothing and allowing Syria to fall back into the hands of the Islamic State and the Assad regime and, you know, expand further in Iraq.
There is, of course, another view that one could hold, and that is that as the US escalates, this will also aid in the recruitment of ISIS in and of itself. You know, there is an argument that ISIS wants the Americans to come in heavier.
Yeah, absolutely. The more the US intervenes, the more ISIS can use its jihadist framework to say, now we have proof that we are indeed fighting these quote-unquote crusades, as it calls the West and the United States specifically. So, of course, more jihadists are going to, rally around ISIS. However, if the military campaign results in a significant weakening of the Islamic State militarily, then this will negate this initial drive, you know, that is based on the jihadist rhetoric that I expect will increase as a result of U.S. intervention.
Lena, I thank you very much. Lena Hatib, helping us understand what's going on in Middle Eastern politics. Lena is director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. And this is LNL on RN. And as I said, we're returning to Hong Kong and the current political fireworks. So let's turn our attention to a closer neighbour, a place where many of us had high hopes in relation to matters democratic, but too much to wish for, it would seem, as Beijing's insisting on having their way in that tiny country's forthcoming elections. Plans for Hong Kong's election of its own chief executive by its mere 7 million inhabitants was a promise Beijing made back in 1997, when I was attending that famous handover. And we were all sorts of trouble and strife have now erupted in the past few months involving a mix of pro-democracy advocates. And to clarify what was promised and what's been delivered, I welcome Dr. John Lee from the Department of Government and International Relations at Sydney Uni, and on Skype from Hong Kong, Professor Joseph Cheng from City University. And Joseph is also convener of the Alliance for True Democracy. John, let's give this some political context. I well recall that interesting phrase, one country, two systems. That was the promise. What was it meant to deliver?
Well, this was the promise that the British and the Chinese hatched together prior to the handover in 1997. And the promise was that China would maintain the Hong Kong system way of life for the next 50 years, so until 2047. Now, what that meant, obviously, it all's up for interpretation. Part of the problem is that it's the People's Republic of China's legal right, if you like, and also capacity to reinterpret what the way of life for the Hong Kong people means. So, yes, there will be one person, one vote in 2017, but there won't be democracy as such.
Now, all matters except foreign policy and military defence were ceded or to be decided by the Hong Kong government. That's correct, isn't it?
That's correct, but the People's Republic of China was still given the capacity, as far as China's concerned anyway, to interpret the basic law or the constitution, and the way that they've interpreted the procedures for coming up with the election 2017 is in a way that essentially gets them the candidate that they want.
I can well remember the paradox of Hong Kong with its seething vitality, its free trade, then in contrast with mainland China. But of course, these days, mainland China is more like one huge Hong Kong in terms of trade. But political rights seem to be increasingly suppressed in Hong Kong.
Well, the aim of the mainland China was that as China grew richer and as Hong Kong became the gateway into China and as the two economies became intertwined and all that's happened, but the hope of China was that as that happened, the Hong Kong people would increasingly look to China as their own country. Now, actually, the reverse has happened. If you look at all of the polls that have been conducted, less than 20% of the people in Hong Kong consider themselves Chinese. 80% of people consider themselves Hong Kong, the Hong Kong people. So, you know, the Chinese have a very narrow view of human beings sometimes. They tend to think that the heart will tend to go where the money is. Well, in the case of Hong Kong, that hasn't occurred.
Okay, let's now go to Hong Kong and talk to Joseph Cheng as convener of the Alliance for True Democracy. Joseph, you've been involved in pro-democracy matters for 30 years. Now, I understand that whilst many are protesting in the streets, what you've been doing is meeting endlessly with Chinese officials to try and the slow drip method.
Well, we have been trying hard to persuade the Chinese authorities that democracy for Hong Kong is actually something good for all parties concerned. We have been trying to say that at this stage, without a democratic electoral system, the government in Hong Kong will not be seen to be legitimate by the people, and therefore it will find it extremely difficult to realize effective governance. At the same time, we try to tell Beijing that you have been trying very hard to win over Taiwan, and if under the one country, two systems model, you don't even allow Hong Kong people to enjoy basic democracy, how can your Taiwan policy be credible and persuasive? And certainly we also raised the issue of the Chinese leadership's image as a reformer domestically and internationally.
You must be an enormously patient fellow in that you sit down, you present ideas for reform via peaceful nonviolence, but you don't get a lot of response.
Yes, we realize the difficulties. If you ask Hong Kong people, the bulk of the population will say, yes, we want democracy. Public opinion surveys in the past 20, 30 years have consistently reflected that up to 70% or a bit more of the people in Hong Kong want democracy. But at the same time, we have to appreciate that our economy is very much dependent on that of mainland China, and it is extremely difficult for a small place like Hong Kong to challenge the Chinese authorities. So there is quite a strong sense of accommodation and compromise on the part of the population in Hong Kong. But however, in the recent years, grievances and dissatisfaction have been accumulating. People certainly have been increasingly dissatisfied with the widening of the gap between the rich and poor, the increasing incidence of corruption, the strengthening of the perception that there is a lot more collusion between big businesses and the government and so on. So people believe that democracy should be part of the solution to all these serious problems.
LNL on RN, and my guests are Joseph Cheng in Hong Kong and John Lee here in Australia. John, would you be kind enough to explain to me this three candidates business and the vote by 1,200 officials? What's all that about?
Right. This really is a point of contention. I mean, as mentioned, every Hong Kong adult will get to vote in 2017, so one person, one vote. Now, so far, so good. The problem is that the candidates will be chosen by a 1,200-member committee. There'll be no more than two or three candidates. The 1,200-member committee are stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. And to even be able to run as a candidate, you need to have a majority of that 1,200-member committee nominate you. That means that the pro-democracy activists, who constitute around one-third of that 1,200-member, will have no candidates. So it's a classic thing that you don't rig the election at the time of the voting. You rig the election prior to that in determining the candidates.
So in a sense, China has broken the spirit but not the letter of the law.
That's correct. I think China has been quite clever. What they've done is that through, whether it be economic seduction or in some cases coercion, over a period of quite a number of years, they have installed their people or people loyal to their interests in the various Hong Kong bodies. So China can now say that we will proceed according to the letter of the law, but as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you won't get democracy because you won't actually get to vote for the candidates you want to vote for.
Is there any international pressure available, John? Do the British have the slightest influence?
No, there is no direct international pressure available. Hong Kong is a special administrative region of China, so it's under jurisdiction of China. The only light I can see at the end of the tunnel for Hong Kong is that the other country under this one country, two systems title is, of course, Taiwan. Now, what the Taiwanese fear most of all is to lose their way of life. And I think an argument could be made by both people in Hong Kong and around the world that if China proceeds to treat Hong Kong this way, this will decrease the incentive for Taiwanese to eventually integrate back into the mainland. And of course, that is ultimately China's highest foreign policy priority.
Joseph Chang, we're having this discussion at a time when, you know, when Beijing's under new management, when there seems to be a new spirit about the place, where certainly the projections internationally show at least subtle changes. Are you feeling any of this coming through in the Hong Kong negotiations?
Well, unfortunately, it seems that the new leadership in Beijing is not interested in democracy at all. There are a number of factors which probably go against granting genuine democracy to Hong Kong. In the first place, Xi Jinping has actually been trying to concentrate power in his hands so much so that he will be in a position to combat corruption more effectively and to introduce economic reforms more efficiently. He has no serious political reforms in mind in his domestic agenda. And secondly, the situation in Tibet and Xinjiang is not developing in favor of the Chinese leadership, in the sense that the difficulties, the problems of the ethnic minorities concerned have been deteriorating. So, and for all these reasons, it seems that the Chinese authorities have in fact tightening the political scene even in China. Suppression of human rights lawyers, of NGOs, and even monitoring of the internet and so on have all been tightening in the past 3-4 years. So one has to admit that the general atmosphere in China is not favorable to granting democracy to Hong Kong.
John, do you agree with that? I would have thought there have been some signs of moderation from Beijing.
I do agree with Joseph, actually. The signs of moderation are in non-political matters. So in China, for example, you can, you know, watch most movies that you want as long as no political implications. You can generally do what you want as long as there are no political implications. But when it comes to political power, China has gone backwards. Xi Jinping has certainly centralized power in himself, but China as a country, the role of the Chinese Communist Party, the political role has actually been strengthened, not weakened, despite these 30, 40 years of economic growth.
How important, John, is Hong Kong to China?
It's important for a number of demonstration reasons. First of all, Hong Kong's a special administrative region. Now, the two other SARs are Tibet and Xinjiang. If you were to have
Tibet's not a roaring success, is it?
No, well, that's the point. If you were to have this thriving, autonomous democracy in Hong Kong, the two other SARs, Tibet and Xinjiang, would want to ask for the same thing. There's another more external reason, and that is that China has spent the last 10, 15 years trying to convince the region and the world that liberal democracy is fundamentally unsuited to Asian Confucian cultures. Now, if you have a thriving liberal democracy in Hong Kong, if you have one in Taiwan, which you already do, you're starting to get one in Singapore, that argument holds less and less weight. So there is a thematic grand narrative at play here, or a contest of the grand narrative at play, and China's very well aware of that.
Joseph, I understand that you've experienced personal intimidation because of your efforts.
Yes, unfortunately, there has been a bit of white terror in Hong Kong in the recent 3-4 months, and various pro-democracy activists have come under pressure. Perhaps I have been selected as a kind of negative example, in the sense that pressure on me may induce self-censorship on the part of other academics and so on. And we are a bit concerned in this way, because under such circumstances, we are not only fighting for a genuinely democratic political system. We are, in fact, fighting to maintain our core values, our lifestyles, and our very dignity as individuals. And we are very concerned that Hong Kong may well be reduced to just another big city in mainland China. We are losing that Hong Kong spirit.
John, let's, as this winds up, let's look at Taiwan. They must be watching to see what integration might look like, you know, because Taiwan may not always have the US looking after them.
Well, Taiwan has been hoping that with economic integration and with mainland Chinese tourists and business people travelling to Taiwan and seeing how free people live, Taiwan have been hoping that this will itself transform China. Now, the problem is that many of the Chinese people might want to live like that, but the Chinese Communist Party doesn't want the country to be like that. So, ultimately that's the problem with authoritarian societies, that the leaders, the interests of the leaders are often not aligned with the interests of the people. So the Taiwanese are hoping to transform China, but there's very little indication of any political transformation.
A final question to you, Joseph. Would it be Beijing bullying all the way to the ballot box?
I guess so. Beijing really wants to control the elections. Basically, the Chinese authorities cannot countenance a kind of scenario that a candidate whom it does not favor can win. And what we are planning to do is a kind of long-term, peaceful, non-violent political struggle. We try to initiate various types of non-cooperation campaigns to exert pressure on the government, and to show that we have not given up, we shall continue to fight for democracy.
And on that optimistic note, I have to say goodbye to you both. Thank you very much, Joseph Cheng, in the Chair of Political Science at City University in Hong Kong, and to you, Dr. John Lee, from the Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney. This is LNL on RN, and coming up, Australia's very own Jewish concentration camp. Well, beloved listeners, I have been telling the story over and over again of the De Niro boys for the last 25 years, the extraordinary story of how Australia had its first official concentration camp holding, would you believe, Jews. It was a fairly congenial camp, however, and the people in it were quite brilliant, an extraordinary variety of talented characters, undoubtedly the most extraordinary refugees we've ever received, and the relationships with the Australian guards was pretty congenial. But what had happened to them before they arrived in our concentration camp was pretty bloody terrible. I'm delighted to be joined tonight by one of the De Niro boys, probably the youngest, and we're not quite sure, but he may in fact be the only absolutely authentic survivor. He was born 90 years ago. He was only about 15 when his parents sent him to Britain to escape the Nazis as part of the refugee children's movement. His parents would die in Auschwitz, while Walter joined 2,500 men and boys, German and Austrian refugees, many of them scientists, academics, artists, musicians, on a very strange trip from Britain to Australia. Conditions on the De Niro were appalling. Many were victims of premeditated cruelty on the part of British soldiers. It's a shameful moment in Britain's military history and one they would much prefer to forget. Yet the De Niro boys' contribution to this country is beyond parallel. As I've told you before, many stayed to fill very high office in every area of Australian life, but in particularly in academia and the arts. The name of my guest is Walter Kaufmann, who's enjoyed an extraordinary life as a winner, an award-winning writer of over 30 books, novels, travel writing and essays. And he's currently and briefly back in Australia, and I welcome him to our Wireless program. Walter, there's been a commemoration this week in Sydney.
That's right, yes, 2 days ago.
Tell me briefly about it.
Well, there's not all that much to tell. There were about 40 people who were concerned with the De Niro relations and sons and brothers and whatever, and only three actual De Niro men, De Niro boys, as they're called, which is a term that I don't like all that much. I'd rather say De Niro person. There were three of us, all of them over 90. I was the youngest of the three. I'm 90. The other two, I think, are 91, 92. Anyhow, pretty old men.
And I understand that you're being followed by a German film crew.
No, by an Australian film crew. An Australian was asked to do some filming on my life and my experiences in Australia, and photograph me while I'm walking through beautiful parts of Sydney, which meant so much to me in the past. And he's taken some shots. 2 days we worked on it, and I think he did a very good job despite the rainy, blowy weather. It was right. The weather was fine in the sense that the clouds were there, there was color, there was atmosphere, and I think the two of us did a great job of coming back to Australia through the time that I knew when I was young.
Now, Walter, there's absolutely no way you could possibly know or remember this, but I met you 60 years ago when I was a 15-year-old member of the Communist Party, and we had a great many friends in common, David Martin, Frank Hardy, et al. I was fascinated by the Realist Writers Association, of which you were a member, and by that remarkable publishing firm, the Australasian Book Society, which was responsible for turning out any number of quite important novels, including your own. Would you like to tell us how your writing career began? And I suggest you do this by reading something from your new biography.
Well, I can just begin exactly at the point that you've mentioned. It's part of my autobiography, which I wrote a couple of years back, which was published in German, because I wrote it in German, of course. It's called Im Fluss der Zeit. In English, it would be In the Currents of Time. And the section that you would like to hear, I guess, is right here before my eyes. And it begins, let me see, I've got it here. In Australia then, in 1949, having published several short stories in Mianjin, a literary journal edited by Clem Christen, I was accepted in the Realist Writers Group, where I met some well-known authors. Alan Marshall, for one, with his widely read I Can Jump Puddles, and a war veteran named Eric Lambert, who had written novels about battles in the jungle of New Guinea and battles in deserts around Tobruk. And I met Frank Hardy, an Australian writ large, who drank hard and played hard and proved to be a brilliant yarn spinner, a literary talent to boot, who wrote stories in the Henry Lawson tradition and was currently working on a novel called Power Without Glory that would make him famous not only in Australia, but worldwide too.
I understand that both Frank and David Martin, urged you to pick up, to write your own story, to write Voices in the Storm.
All right, I'm coming to that right here. The next part of this extract goes on to exactly Voices in the Storm. And I acquainted John Morrison, who wrote well-crafted stories about farm workers, gardeners, waterside workers, but closest to me came David Martin, a Hungarian Jew who had written the famous Hagama Front song while in an international brigade during the Spanish Civil War. Previous to that, and later, he had written and published novels set in India, Wales, and Palestine, a widely traveled man indeed. Like the others, he felt that I should hold on to my job with Elite Photos. Everything including the way I earned my living as a photographer of weddings should be grist on the mill for me, be good for my writing, provided I really could write.
What I want to do is remind you of the time that lay ahead when the comrades in Australia were under enormous political stress as a result of developments back in the Soviet Union. And many of us were either expelled or resigned, or in some cases it was hard to work out, a bit of both, from the party. You, however, had chosen to go back to East Germany. Why did you make that decision?
You're making a big jump from the time that I became a writer in Australia to the time I decided to go back to East Germany. I had been in Australia for many years, and I was much of an Australian already. I had worked on the waterfront. I went to sea among seamen. I was a member of the Seamen's Union. And as a member of the Seamen's Union, I was delegated to the Soviet Union and to Poland. And in Poland, while there was a youth festival, I met a German publisher, a wonderful man who had been in Gestapo prisons, who had been mistreated in Gestapo prisons, who had lost an eye in the process, and who impressed me not because of his physical appearance, but because of his gentle, wonderful, human way he had with people. And he urged me to let Voices in the Storm be published in Germany, which he read in English. And that book was published, not immediately, but by and by. And other stories of mine were published in East Germany, and a great number of books, or not a great, how does that sound? A number of books that I'd written were successively being published in East Germany, which was one anchor for me to go there, one magnet, as it were, but not the only one. It was a political decision in the end. It was a political decision to be in a country that was striving to be socialist. A Germany, another Germany, the other Germany, as I had hoped, but that's a hope that that was frustrated in the end.
At what point, or did you ever, in fact, become disenchanted with the regime, with the Communist Party?
Let me put it this way. I never became disenchanted because the Australian communists that I have met, wonderful leaders of the trade union movement, never disenchanted me in one little bit. They were forthright men, fighting men, up upstanding Australians, and those were the men that I was influenced by. I'll tell you a few names. Bill Bird in Melbourne was the leader of the Seamen's Union of Victoria. E.V. Elliott was a well-known trade unionist in here in New South Wales, leading the seamen. There was Healy of the waterside workers, and there was in particular in Melbourne a man named George Seeleff, who was the trade union leader for the butcher's workers working
I remember Seeleff established a remarkably good hospital for his injured butchers, and the young doctor that ran it was Moss Cass, who finished up being a Whitlam minister.
Oh, I see. Look, that's something I didn't know, but what he did do was encourage us to get our books to the workers. He helped the Australasian Book Society in the very moment it was founded, and he put the trade union movement behind that organization, behind that book society, in the sense that he opened doors for us. He opened doors for us not only in the abattoirs. I only read in one abattoir for out of my stories, but later on it broadened out to readings and short addresses on ships, on the waterfront, and particularly I remember here in New South Wales, my reading before miners in Wollongong. That was one of the most remarkable experiences of my writing life, to be among miners, to read out of an anti-fascist story, an anti-fascist book about the struggle of workers against Hitler, and they listened to me with attention and sympathy, and on the spot they bought whole pile of books. In fact, I sold out of the 5,000 copies that were sold of Voices in the Storm in the Australasian Book Society, 2,000 myself, which is quite an effort, believe me.
I think we should also tell the listener about your work, The Curse of Maralinga, of course, about the testing there of A-bombs and how it affected Indigenous Australians. I know that that book was well received in East Germany, but it was also very prescient.
Yes, it was a poignant story. It culminated in the death of three Aborigines that I had heard about, who did not die because of the atomic tests. They died because they had been deprived of their land or been taken off their land and put elsewhere in order not to be hurt by the atomic bomb. But when they were displaced, as it were, from their original land, they could not find the water holes that were necessary for their survival. And a young Australian explorer for minerals and a young American explorer for minerals found these three people on their way to a waterhole which they had just made, but they died before they got there. It was a very significant story which has moved me to write that short novelette called The Curse of Maralinga.
I've just been rereading a nice piece about you by your old friend Max Watts, and he makes the point that you always push the boundaries in your writing, whether you were here or indeed in East Germany. You wrote a book called Fluked about the escape of an East German doctor to the West. How did you get that? Through the communist censors?
Well, there were all sorts of things that happened under the skies. The publishers were very impressed with the book. They knew that they would have trouble publishing it. They told me that there would be no publicity whatsoever if they did publish it. And they sort of got it through in ways that I can now not describe. The fact was that the book Flucht, meaning flight, was published in East Germany in an enormously large edition without having had one single review in the paper. I think it was 100,000 copies that were sold, including the pocketbook edition. So my satisfaction was great, the satisfaction to have brought it out was enormous for me. And, of course, the readers had a book in front of them that told them the truth about the reasons of a doctor for leaving the country. And he happened to be a very close friend of mine, and I based my story on this friendship and the knowledge of that particular escape.
When the wall came down, you were one of the very few East German writers who continued to get their work published by West German publishers.
Yes, that's true, but believe me, it was a new beginning. I'm now in a situation where, after the fall of the wall, I was then in the situation that I had to begin from scratch, absolutely as if I were a new unknown writer. The publishing houses that had existed in East Germany were all defunct. In other words, they had closed their doors. I had to find a new publisher, and I found a new publisher after almost a year of searching, a small publishing house in West Berlin, and that was the beginning. That was the beginning of a new career, a very slow, a very modest career. I cannot say that I've uprooted trees, as they say in Germany, Bäume ausreißen. I cannot say that I've had any success comparable to that which I had in East Germany, but I had a modest, steady success that culminated in a really very good success when, in Flüsterzeit, in the currents of time, was published.
Walter, when you think back on your years in Hay, how do you feel about them now? Are you bitter or are you happy they happened?
Neither. I'm not bitter, nor am I happy. I can only say that it was a formative time of my life, that it was the first confrontation with Australians. Even though they were soldiers, even though they were guarding us, I found them to be very human, very direct, and very honest once they realized who we were. I tell you, that began even on the journey to Hay. Once they realized we were Jews, one of the soldiers got up with his rifle and knocked the bars from the windows because he thought there was no need for any bars for these people. And then he sat down next to me and he said, Where did they nab you, mate? And I said, and I realized what he was talking about. He thought I was a German captured in the war, and made it clear to him that no, that I was a Jew. And then he realized, my God, what the hell are we doing here guarding these people? What the hell for? And he sat down and he rolled a smoke and he said, "You smoke?" And I said, "No, but I'll teach you how to roll a cigarette." He told me, and he said, Jews, well, I knew a clever Jew in Sydney. He made my teeth, and he showed me his teeth. And we got matey. After the journey was ended, we were shaking hands.
Great story, Walter. Walter, it's wonderful to talk to you. Walter Kaufmann, now 90, perhaps certainly the youngest of the De Niro boys, and as he points out, one of four survivors. Thanks, Walter. Thanks, listeners, and thanks, team. Sound engineer Marty Peralta, producers Penny Lomax, Mudita Diaz, and Stan Corry, and EP Gail Basario. For more information about any of our programs, you simply visit our website, whack Late Night Live into your search engine, and we'll be talking to you again next week. Have a wonderful weekend.
We've got to be careful that we're not judgmental, calling these people lazy, gluttons, or stupid. They have a regulatory disease.
Australia is quickly becoming one of the fattest countries in the world. Almost two-thirds of us are now overweight or obese. Experts are calling it a crisis. Many doctors say it can only be fixed with surgery and drugs. Hear the uncomfortable things you need to know, but the surgeons won't tell you. You can download this health report from the RN website.